There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. I'm your host, Bill Couch. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 21, titled The Prime Mover. This was written by Charles Beaumont, directed by Richard L. Baer, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant, Renee Gerowink, and Jerry Goldsmith. In the cast were Dane Clark, Buddy Ebsen, and Christine White. Its original air date was March 24th of 1961. And you can watch this on Tubi TV, Freevee TV, Paramount Plus, or the excellent DVDs and Blu-rays. And again, as I always say, if you have a little bit of extra money to spend, go ahead and get the Blu-rays of The Twilight Zone. They're well worth it. So, if you haven't seen this episode, just be a fair warning. As always, I will tell you there are spoilers ahead. So if you haven't seen this episode since Reagan came up with the idea for trickle-down economics, then go ahead and pause this episode of the podcast and go watch that episode. Come back and listen to it and listen and pick up this episode of the podcast where you left off. As always, I would love to hear your feedback, suggestions, ideas about previous episodes or future episodes. So if you would, give me drop me an email at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. So with that, let's get it to the opening narration. Portrait of a man who thinks and thereby gets things done. Mr. Jimbo Cobb might be called a prime mover, a talent which has to be seen to be believed. In just a moment, he'll show his friends and you how he keeps both feet on the ground and his head in the Twilight Zone. So, in Rod Serling's opening, we see him just step out from in a soundstage from behind some bushes or behind a tree or something. It's not the greatest intro, but it does start with one of the more, I guess, often quoted narration lines from The Twilight Zone in Portrait of a Man, along with Submitted for Your Approval being another quite famous one. But the opening isn't as in the scene as we've seen in some of the previous episodes, like Static, where he's in the basement where the radio is being pulled out of and up to Mr. Lindsay's room, you know, that sort of thing. We sort of just see him appear out of a, you know, behind some fake trees in a studio. But never fear, there will be better ones on the horizon. So the story starts out with Jimbo and his buddy Ace, who own the Happy Days Cafe somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Nevada, along with their waitress / Ace's love interest, Kitty, played by Christine White. We see Ace sweet-talking what we think would be Kitty, and it turns out to be a slot machine. Now, we've seen the slot machine before. We've seen it in the episode The Fever. So Ace puts his last quarter in the slot machine. It doesn't pay off. And he goes to the bar to ask Kitty for another quarter, and the waitress, you know, Kitty, kind of gives him a little flack about it, but she gives him a quarter, and he winds up flipping coins with the truck driver that was eating at the counter to basically, you know, double or nothing, so he might get his quarter back to try again and not take money out of the till. The truck driver subsequently wins the coin toss, takes the quarter, goes to the slot machine, puts the money in the slot machine, and walks out with a hat full of quarters, subsequently giving Ace his quarter and saying, "Here's your quarter back. I appreciate it." And he walks out. We then hear a crash and see a crash where a car runs off the road, rolls over, and it goes into up against the fence of a substation, causing the fence that is now touching the upside down car to become electrified. Ace and Jimbo and Kitty hear it. They go outside, and this is where the episode really starts to get going. Ace tells Jimbo, you know, we got to do something. Jimbo essentially, and I know this, I'm going to get some hate for this, and that's perfectly fine, but Jimbo basically uses the force and puts the car back on its roof. And we find out later through a little bit of exposition between Jimbo, Ace, and Kitty talking that the people in the car are going to be fine. They just had a few broken bones, but they should heal up, and no one was killed or anything of the sort. This, of course, makes Ace and Jimbo somewhat happy. And later when Ace and Jimbo are talking about it in their room, he asks Jimbo, Ace asks Jimbo, you know, where'd you get this? You know, how could you do that? And Jimbo explains that he's always been able to do it, and it got him in trouble in school, and he kind of quit doing it because he figured everyone could do it and no one just did it. And plus, he kept getting in trouble in school and kept, you know, this and that. Plus, he got terrible headaches after doing it, like he had currently after saving people's lives by flipping a car back over and having it not be electrified anymore. So Ace, being a greedy person, I guess you could say at best, decided that he was mad at Jimbo because Jimbo could have been using this power to make them rich. And so Ace gets the idea that he wants to take Jimbo and Kitty to Las Vegas to gamble, since Ace has the ability to, or since Jimbo has the ability to make dice roll a certain way, etc., etc. And so Ace calls Kitty, tells her to pack her stuff for a quick couple of nights, and he'll meet her, you know, he'll come pick her up. They get in the car, they go to Vegas, and they start to gamble. Roulette, then craps, then, you know, several different games. Jimbo uses his powers for essentially cheating, and they wind up winning essentially about $200,000 in the cheating with Jimbo using his powers to manipulate the dice, manipulate the ball and the roulette table, etc., etc. Kitty, of course, completely unaware that Jimbo has any powers, decides that, you know, hey, maybe we should just go back to the room because, you know, your luck can't last forever. Of course, Ace doesn't want to hear anything about this, but Jimbo says, well, I've kind of got a splitting headache. Can we go back to the room? Ace starts to give him the business, as they used to say, but then he realizes, wait a minute, this is the guy that actually got us $200,000. Maybe I should be nice to him. Let's go back up to the room. We'll get him some Tylenol. He can lay down for a while, etc., etc. So they go up to the room. They get a suite. Kitty goes to get, Jimbo some aspirin, and Ace still on an adrenaline rush from winning $200,000 by essentially cheating, decides he wants to go paint the town, quote unquote, with Kitty. Kitty asks him if he's done. He's not done gambling. They'll do it one more time tomorrow because now Jimbo has decided, you know, hey, we're kind of cheating and this is wrong. And Ace says, yeah, you're not wrong. We'll do it one more time and then we'll call it a day. Kitty gets upset at this. She doesn't want any more to do with it because she hasn't figured out how it's cheating, but she figures out they're cheating and she doesn't want any more part of it. So she decides to leave. How she plans on getting back to the house, to her home, we never really figure out, but she leaves. And Ace is in the lobby. He spots the cigarette, candy, or a chewing gum girl that we saw a little earlier. He offers to give her money in exchange for hanging out with him for the evening, which isn't really legal in Vegas, although they do practice it. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's kind of weird that they threw this into a Twilight Zone episode. I know you're going to look at it and say, well, it's not really what it was. And you can look at it both ways, I suppose. Maybe I'm just an idiot. But it just seemed kind of weird, like he was buying companionship for the night. Not necessarily meaning anything nefarious or overtly sexual, but still, you're still buying someone's time. There are words for that. However, he did talk to her manager and slipped him a couple grand, and the manager was cool with it, essentially making him a PIMP, I guess if you want to totally go with it. If you want to lean into that idea, I guess you could say. There you go. So he goes to, you know, hang out with her, but before he leaves, he asks the floor manager, who's the whale in town? The man with the biggest pockets. And we find out it's a gangster from Chicago. So Ace wants to set up a game with him for the next day, tells him, you know, have this man call me. So it's now the next morning. We see Jimbo in bed. The phone starts ringing. He uses the force to bring the phone over to the bed. He answers the phone. It's the gangster from Chicago wanting to play, or wanting to gamble some money with Ace. Jimbo gives the phone to Ace, tells him who it is. Ace pops up, hits himself in the head with the phone, which I thought was kind of funny, and invites him up to his room to come gamble. So a minute later, we see them come in. You know, it's burly men in three-piece suits, all looking dapper as can be, as you would expect a Chicago crime syndicate boss to look like. And Ace decides to order some breakfast. Jimbo seems disinterested. They start gambling, throwing dice, and Ace is winning and winning and winning and winning. The mobster is getting more and more upset, thinking he's cheating, although they can't prove it. And Ace decides to shoot the works about the time his new girlfriend, the cigarette lady, comes in. And Jimbo all the time is trying to tell him that he's lost his ability. He can't control the dice anymore, but Ace doesn't want to hear it. Ace bets the farm on one more roll of the dice. He rolls the dice, he gets a 3, and he loses every dime they had. That they had won, you know, in the gambling. The mobster takes his money, laughs at him, tells him if he ever wants to play again, give him a call. And the new girlfriend decides to leave because it's no longer financially viable for her to be there anymore. So she exits stage right, and Jimbo and Ace go home. They go back to their, lives, except this time Ace is having the slot machine removed from their establishment, and he has come to his senses and decides to ask Kitty to marry him. When he does that, Jimbo drops the broom. Ace asks her to marry him. She says yes. And they run off to, do whatever. Jimbo uses the force to pick up the broom. And the episode comes to an end. And with that, let's get to the closing narration. Some people possess talent. Others are possessed by it. When that happens, the talent becomes a curse. Jimbo Cobb knew, right from the beginning. But before Ace Larson learned that simple truth, he had to take a short trip through the Twilight Zone. So, rather an interesting episode. It's one that I don't watch very often. Not because I hate it. Not because I think it's a horrible episode. Just because it's one of those episodes to me that kind of feels like it gets lost in the shuffle. It's not a bad episode. It's not a stellar episode. But it just seems like it gets lost in the sauce. In the marathons and everything else. You might run across it. You might not. And some people might think it's a fantastic episode. Some people might put it down at the bottom. Who knows? The whole idea is subjective. The whole list of what is the best and what is the worst and what are the middle episodes of The Twilight Zone is all subjective. And that's the beauty of any art form, of any medium, be it television, radio, musicals, pictures, paintings, comedy, anything. It's all subjective, and that's what makes it a beautiful endeavor. One man's trash is another man's Picasso. And let's never forget that, all 15 of you that are listening to me. It's all subjective. So there's no reason to get in a tizzy about it. It's all subjective. If you don't like it, turn it off. If you like it, turn it up louder. We're all adults. But getting back on topic, this episode. I don't hate this episode, but I don't love this episode. To me, it's middle of the road as you can get. Which is a shame, because I really like Buddy Ebsen. I always watched reruns of the Beverly Hillbillies when I was a kid, mostly because it came on around the same time as Andy Griffith or whatever show I also liked to watch that was from a time before me that I used to watch on reruns. And he was also Barnaby Jones, and I always kind of liked that show for some reason. I don't know why, don't ask me, and I haven't seen it for probably 30 years. I haven't seen that show. But I remember liking it as a child. But not even Buddy Ebsen could make this episode fantastic, sadly. And like I said, I like Buddy Ebsen, but here we are. So with that, let's get into, speaking of Buddy Ebsen, the bios. Now, this episode was directed by Richard L. Baer, who, if you want to learn more about him, go back to Season 1, Episode 14, Third from the Sun. I discuss him there. And just listen to that episode and watch that actual episode of The Twilight Zone, because it's literally one of the best ones that's ever been made. And Richard L. Baer directed it, and you should watch it. It's a fantastic episode. And while you're at it, go back and listen to my episode of the podcast about that. Or even don't. I don't care. I just want you to watch that episode. It's a fantastic episode. It's literally one of my favorites. Please go watch it. The awesome thing about Richard L. Baer was that he also directed pretty much every episode of Green Acres. So imagine the man, after you watch that episode, or while you're watching that episode, think, this is the same guy that dealt with Ava Gabor and Arnold the Pig. So think about that. But he did direct several episodes from The Twilight Zone, Matter of fact, he directed two episodes each season from seasons 1, 2, and 3, and one episode in season 5. And he directed some of the better episodes. Like I said, Third from the Sun, he directed. Nick of Time with William Shatner, which is also a fantastic one. He also directs the widely loved by anyone who's not even a Twilight Zone fan, episode 24 of season 3, To Serve Man. So he's a competent director, but I feel like he didn't have a lot of stuff to work with on this episode, and that's a shame. But if you want to listen to Richard L. Bear's biography, go back to season 1, episode 14, Third from the Sun. So let's talk about Ace Larson. The man who played Ace Larson was known as Mr. Dane Clark, not to be confused with Dane Cook. Dane Clark actually had talent. Dane Clark was actually born Bernard Elliott Zanville in 1912, and he passed away at the age of 86 in 1998. He was the son of Jewish immigrants. He graduated from Cornell University along with Andy Bernard. There's a little office inside for you. As well as graduating from St. John's Law School in Brooklyn. In the Depression era, he had trouble finding work, so he tried boxing, baseball, construction, sales, modeling, and various other jobs. And he wound up stumbling into acting, appearing on Broadway in Dead End, Stage Door, and Of Mice and Men, which finally brought him to Hollywood, where he acted under his own name until 1943, when, advised by Humphrey Bogart, who gave him the stage name Dane Clark, took the role of sailor Johnny Pulaski in Warner Brothers' Action in the North Atlantic, which was a wartime tribute to the Merchant Marines. This led him to other parts in World War II movies such as Destination Tokyo, God is My Co-Pilot, and Pride of the Marines in 1945. He starred along luminaries such as Humphrey Bogart, Cary Grant, Betty Davis, and Raymond Massey, but he didn't have the stellar leading man good looks like Bogart and Cary Grant and so on and so forth, so he never was really able to make a break into like the leading man roles, so he wound up in more of the average Joe sort of roles, so he more or less was typecast into a character actor due to his looks. This led him to have 201 credits on his IMDb, appearing in movies, television shows, literally anything that you can think of from the 60s and 70s. If it was on TV, chances are this man had a small role in it. And his last on-screen appearance was in two episodes of Murder, She Wrote with everyone's favorite Angela Lansbury. And again, sadly, passed away at the age of 86 in 1998. Now, let's talk about the man who would be Jed Clampett, but who played Jimbo Cobb in this episode of The Twilight Zone, Mr. Buddy Ebsen. Now, Buddy Ebsen was born in 1908 and passed away at the age of 95 in 2003. He began his career as a dancer in the late 20s in a Broadway chorus. He later went on to form a vaudeville act with his sister, Vilma Ebsen, who also appeared on Broadway. In 1935, he and his sister went to Hollywood, where they were signed for the first of MGM's Eleanor Powell movies, Broadway Melody of 1936, which was, of course, came out in 1935. Vilma retired shortly after this, but Buddy kept going. He starred in two more MGM movies with Powell. Two of his dancing partners were Francis Langford in Born to Dance, 1936, and America's Sweetheart, Judy Garland, in Broadway Melody of 1938, which of course came out in 1937. MGM studio chief Louis B. Mayer offered him an exclusive contract in 1938, but Buddy turned it down. In spite of Mayer's warning that he would never get a job in Hollywood again, Ebsen was offered the role of the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. Ebsen agreed to change roles with Ray Bolger, who was cast as the Tin Man. Ebsen subsequently became ill from the aluminum makeup that was used for makeup for the Tin Man, and was replaced by Jack Haley. He returned to the stage, making only a few pictures before he got a role in the Disney production of Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, in 1955. After this, he became a straight actor, and later, of course, won much fame with his role as Jed Clampett in the Beverly Hillbillies, and of course continuing that fame with Barnaby Jones in the 70s. The man who Louis B. Mayer said would never work again amassed a total of 250 credits on his IMDb. As we've discussed, basically any TV show of the 50s and 60s and a lot of the 70s, the man was in it. Even some movies as well. He never really stopped doing movies either. And his last on-screen, if you could call it, appearance was in one episode of King of the Hill in 1999, where he was the voice of Chet Elderson. If you remember King of the Hill, Chet Elderson was the chief of the firehouse where Hank and them became volunteer firemen in Arlen. And, spoiler alert, subsequently burned the firehouse down. So, a storied career from a fantastic actor who made his fame by playing a hillbilly. Even though he had done a lot of really awesome stuff before that. Which goes to show you, is the case if you look at Alan Rickman. I mean, he didn't really get his start or his big break until he was well into his 40s. So, the business is weird. You never really know what's going to happen and when. Because you got people that are actually talented, they might not get a break until later in life. If you look at the comedy side, Rodney Dangerfield, same thing. He was a comic when he was younger, and he got married and had children, and quit being a comedian for almost 20 years while he sold aluminum siding. Someone out there has a house that bought aluminum siding from Rodney Dangerfield. And then he decided after he got divorced to go back into comedy again, and the rest is history, as they say. So let's talk about the woman who would be Kitty. She was played by Christine White, who was born in 1926 and passed away at the age of 86 in 2013. She amassed 64 credits on her IMDb, so not nearly the body of work that the two gentlemen in this episode had put forward, but her first on-screen appearance was in an episode of Crime Syndicate in 1951. From then on, she went to be in other various TV shows of the time, like Broadway Television Theater, Hallmark Hall of Fame, Danger, The Man Behind the Badge, Father Knows Best, Climax, Stop Me If You've Heard This, M-Squad, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Thin Man, State Trooper, Have Gun Will Travel, etc., etc., basically playing a lady character actor all through the 50s and into the 60s. She was in two episodes of The Twilight Zone. She was, of course, in this one and in Season 5's Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with William Tiberius Shatner. And as I said, she worked steady through the 50s and 60s, with her last on-screen appearance being in the 1976 movie James Dean, but she was also in 1973, the Dirty Harry movie Magnum Force with Clint Eastwood. Not a lot is known about her other than she retired at around that time and, of course, subsequently passed away around 11 years ago. So that'll do it for the bios. Let's move on to the trivia. The car crash that we see in the beginning of the movie is actually a film clip of the car crash from the end of Thunder Road in 1958, starring Mr. Robert Mitchum. In the opening, a slot machine is used by the main character. The slot machine, of course, as I said, is the same one used in The Fever, where Franklin becomes obsessed with the slot machine and subsequently gets killed by a sentient slot machine. If you want to hear about that episode, go back and listen to it. It's a good episode of the podcast. The title refers to the propulsion unit for a transportation system, such as a locomotive, such as the locomotive on a train, the tractor unit of a semi-tractor trailer, the motor of a locomotive or railroad engine, or the truck that tows an artillery gun. Also in philosophy, it is a self-caused being that is the cause of all things, which I think is more speaking to what Serling might have been, thinking when he named it the Prime Mover, or I should say Charles Beaumont named it the Prime Mover. And lastly, this episode aired on March 24th of 1961, but the calendar on the wall of the diner is from December of 1955. So let's move on to the goofs of the episode. When Ace and Jimbo first go into the casino, the dealer calls seven a winner on one of the rolls before the dice have come to a stop. When Jimbo levitates the phone to answer it from the desk to his bed, the wire suspending it can be seen as the phone moves across the room. When Ace and Jimbo run out to the car just after it crashes, there are electric sparks all over it. Well, on the opposite side of the car, you can clearly see that the sparks are being created by some fuses, like firework fuses. When Jimbo loses all his money by rolling a three craps, one and two on the dice, a split second before that, one die clearly comes to a stop on a six and not a one or a two as shown. Ace, realizing Jimbo has special powers, asks him for a quarter, which he flips, and asks Jimbo to change the flip. Ace then rolls a pair of dice, one of which comes to rest about 6 inches from the quarter, with the second die stopping on the edge of the bed about 18 inches from the quarter. In the close-up, the pair of dice are visible about 6 inches apart, and the second one is nowhere near the edge of the bed. When Jimbo lifts his head to reveal his telekinetic powers, the wire lifts his bed to reveal his telekinetic powers. A wire at the center of the foot of the bed is clearly visible. In the beginning, when Ace plays the slot machine and loses, we see a close-up of the losing combination. There's a cherry on the third reel at the top, above the pay line, yet there is no payout listed on the pay table on the left side of the machine for three cherries. At one point, at about the 18-minute mark, the money stacked on the floor has all the printing backward, but in other shots, it is normal again. So, somewhat some pedantic, I guess you could say, or nitpicky goofs in this episode, but I think we can overlook that. So, let's get into the likes and dislikes of this. Likes. It wasn't a stellar episode. I do love Buddy Ebsen. I think that Dane Clark and Buddy Ebsen and, of course, Christine White all played their parts well, albeit Christine not having a whole lot to do other than to stand there and look pretty, which she did nicely. Again, it's one of those episodes that should have either been an hour long so we could flesh out how we think Jimbo got his powers, or it could have been a 15-minute episode in an anthology series not necessarily related to the Twilight Zone. But as a standalone episode, it's not the worst there ever was, but it's nowhere near the best that there ever was. I thought it was a nice, like I said, middle-of-the-road episode all the way around. With that, let's get into casting. So if Hollywood called me and said, Bill, we're going to be remaking this episode and we want your input on who would you cast in the roles of this episode if we were to redo it, and I would say, Hollywood, here's what I would do. For the role of Ace Larson, I would cast Jamie Foxx, just because he is not necessarily a big guy. He's got somewhat of a smaller frame, but he's got that sort of quick-talking sort of attitude that I think the Ace character really lends itself to. So I would put Jamie Foxx in that role. Now for the role of his buddy Jimbo Cobb, honestly, Idris Elba. I know it's a small part and kind of a crappy one for such a great actor as him to play, but I think he would do fantastic at it. I love Idris Elba. He's a fantastic person. He should be in way more stuff than he's in. So listen to that, Hollywood. Cast that man in more stuff. All right? Get off your duff and do that. And for Kitty, I think Amy Adams, just because, why not? Who doesn't like Amy Adams? You know what I mean? So let's put her in there. I think that would be fantastic. So Jamie Foxx, Idris Elba, Amy Adams. And just for funsies, the role of the cigarette chewing gum girl, I'd put Kate Upton in there. Just for fun. Give Kate Upton something to do. I haven't, she's a name that seems to have disappeared, over some time. Put Kate Upton in there. Why not? So, for the moral and philosophy, I think it's pretty easy to suss this one out, isn't it? Greed is bad. Not listening to what Gordon Gekko from Wall Street might say, greed is bad, and it leads to bad things. And people that are greedy, at least in the Twilight Zone, get a light slap on the wrist of a comeuppance and maybe learn their lesson. And maybe if it worked like that in the real world, we'd have less greedy people. But unfortunately, the Twilight Zone is not the real world, which is why we watch it, to escape the real world for at least a half hour, or at least 24 minutes by the clock. So, pretty easy to suss out. Don't be greedy. There's enough for everyone. You know what I mean? There's enough. If we're good stewards of what we've been given, There's enough for everyone, so don't be greedy. Please. And with that, I think we can bring this one safely into a landing. If you would, stay tuned for next week's episode, where Bill Mummy... Well, you know what? I'm not going to give it away. Bill Mummy talks to his grandma next week in Long Distance Call on the Twilight Zone. Thanks to, again, all 15 of you for listening. I appreciate you more than you know. And have a good night.